Welcome to Mock It. Liz is a user experience strategist turned project manager committed to human-centered driven approaches and results. She has worked on 20-plus higher education, government, and client-facing websites and software platforms, creating long-lasting, user-focused digital solutions. Liz is devoted to equity and strives to celebrate diversity and inclusion in the industry and beyond. Marie is a former visual designer turned agile-loving, human-centered design advocate. They have helped government organizations for almost a decade build successful digital products by aligning cross-functional teams around a deep understanding of the user at the heart of their mission. Marie is passionate about improving user experiences while achieving business objectives in harmony. They are also a strong advocate for women in STEM.
Hi, I'm Marie.
And I'm Liz.
And this is Mock It, a podcast sponsored by MetroStar, where we take a deep dive look into UX design, trending design topics, and chatting with our friends in the field. Let's get started.
So Marie and I have a really cool episode today. We are talking to Joe Early. Joe is the Vice President of Product and Design at MetroStar, and he brings a ton of innovative thinking, strong technical and business acumen, great communication and leadership skills to MetroStar, and we are happy to have you here. Welcome, Joe.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, super excited. Do you want to kick off the episode and just tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Joe. I'm VP Product and Design within our client solutions group. And what that means is we're really an innovation hub for MetroStar at large, where we are able to take customer use cases, bring them in-house and say, how would, within our business model, how would we solve this? And what's the best way to do so? That means the most for our customers, but also that means the most for the MetroStar employees serving it. So some solution sets are DevOps. Some solution sets are machine learning or deep learning, data sciences. And some things are just human-centered design. Kind of talking to you guys today, which is, you know, how do we increase our customer intimacy? How do we speak their language better? How do we make sure we're solving the right problem in the right way with the right technology, if applicable?
Yes. And I feel like I need to share, because I feel like here I'm like, I've got to work with Joe a lot with the CSG group, and it's been super fun. I've mentioned it before how I looked up like AI for dummies to learn about what the group is doing so I can catch up, since I can help bring the human-centered part. But it's been really cool, and I'm excited about this episode because we're talking about data and how you guys have looked into, and I don't want to give away too much of the episode this early on, but looking into data to really help a good cause.
That was a great intro. I'm like, oh, I'm so excited for this episode.
Yeah, let me join CSG too. Yeah.
So before we dive too deep into it, could you give us a little bit of a background on how your interest started in data, but then also could you explain in your own words for our audience what open source means, as well as AI and ML?
Yeah, absolutely, Liz. So way back. So I spent 10 years active duty in the Navy flying, and I was a naval flight officer aboard what is an E2D. That's a ISR platform where we fly around, we stare at computers all day, and we look at the sky. Air traffic control for the sky is probably the best way to explain it. But what is the system that the air traffic controllers look at is really software. So within that software is data that you're collecting every single day, whether they're chats, whether it's video, whether it's your sensor feedback, things that you're getting in. And then I got to experience that whole life cycle within the military of when you find a thing, what do you do and how do you act and communicate in the best interest of the country? Fast forward to 3 years ago. I was the chief digital transformation and chief data officer at the F-35, is on a really complex platform that takes data, aggregates it, and delivers that in a jet that is extremely robust, but is also proliferated worldwide. They have like 14 different countries. So F-35 is one of those systems that not many people understand, is that just purely the data from that jet can support 15 different countries' response to a threat. that's overwhelming when we talk about security, worldwide security. Imagine, you know, standing one person standing up against one bully, but imagine 15 people standing up against one bully who all speak the same language. And that's data. And so that kept my journey going in standing up the data operations for the F-35 and seeing the impact that it can have for our national security. And fast forward to today, where I'm working in the machine learning and AI space, looking at, okay, with this mission set, this growing mission set around the world, how within the government and within organizations like MetroStar can we take data and really enhance our customers' operational insights and picture, but also do good for the community and take what the community's done and save the government a lot of money and really take a rational approach. Human-centered design is critical in thinking about data. Because nobody wants all the data.
No, nobody wants to just look at that data.
So that led me to the open source, some open source solutions where it's like, hey, we could take just enough steps to make the next right decision here. And that is going to save a ton of money. And in the long run, going back to my early days in the Navy is, how are we enabling the operator to just do their job better?
Mm-hmm. So you've talked about open source a lot. Can you talk about why it's such a hot topic in government and any... like maybe, I don't want to say like pushback, but maybe a little bit of resistance or uncomfortability, right? Because open source means, right, it's transparent and we're talking about our government.
Yeah. So open source to me is access, is availability and insights and transparency, like you said, that typically would not be available through a proprietary solution. So when I was at the F-35, we had a ton of tools, but the constraint around the mission was that the insight that those proprietary tools gave was not always as transparent as it could be, because sometimes you're held up, your decision isn't fully realized because there's a constraint around the software. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hey, can you give me insight into this? And they're like, well, that's kind of proprietary. I can't really give you insight into that. Here's your output. And so my outcomes were blocked because sometimes it became more about outputs of the contract and saying, well, we delivered the contract. What else do you want? It's like, well, I need to make a decision. And that's an outcome, right? And so what led me to open source is saying that we can 100% work within the proprietary space, but there's a rational approach to making sure that you have a viable architecture put together that helps both the speed of the mission and responsiveness to changes in the mission that require an additional level of transparency so that you can continue to push forward. So when we talk open source and access, it really is about making sure that we are ensuring flexibility. Including transparency into that. And then what happens is you now start to improve the human-centered design process because you're able to take the feedback. And instead of the platform leading the customer's mission, the customer leads their mission and the platform is responsive in that way. So that's how open source really, for me, creates that transparency and resiliency.
Yeah. And I'll say I saw with the team using Onyx for one of their contracts, I really saw that the client was able to, like, I feel like every day almost was like, oh, actually, we needed to do this or we needed to do this. And the team was like, cool, like, let's go back and figure out how Onyx can do that for them. So, I mean, just to give a like real world example, right? Like, it's not all just saying that. I've seen it in action.
So then I have a question for you too then. So in terms of security, so when I think of open source, I think of something like Drupal, you know, like it has an open source community. It's free. I as a normal person wanting to play around, I can access open source software and different apps and whatever it might be. How do you sell open source as the way path forward or the way forward with security concerns?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's so many aspects of security once you break it down, because one example is the Log4j piece. Log4j was a, it was, I think, malware that was injected, and it was like worldwide. And so you had, it was exposed to the open source community. It was proprietary community. Everybody was affected by it. And it was, how do you remediate this? How do you solve the problem? It was actually open source that detected Log4j. And it was because the community is always looking at the code. The community brings insight into questions that one single team in one single proprietary ecosystem may not know how to ask or recognize. And they say, hey, there's a problem here, or there's an anomaly. Let's take a look at this. In the community, they start to put their head around it. And that access now creates access to a solution. But here's the funny thing is, with like proprietary solutions, you have to, there's profit involved in the remediation of that. So you have to consider that into your backlog. And that backlog is driven by the funds that are now applied to that team or the decision makers of the shareholders. Let's do what's best for the shareholders. So that's a, that could actually be a constraint around the speed in which you respond to a security threat. And then the last piece is on-prem. There are still servers today that are, weren't connected, but are still, the threats, some like Log4j still exist because the on-prem servers have to be manually updated. So speed, community recognition of a threat, it's not if it's going to happen, it's when it happens. And how do you bring that? How does open source allow that to happen? Is just, it just allows it to happen faster.
Yeah, I feel like you hit on, right, with community, right, that's diversity of, right, people's thoughts, their experiences, and all of that, which is such a good thing, right, like in breaking down biases, getting better solutions and stuff is that diverse aspect. And you get that with a community of people across the world. Gosh, I like open source. We tied it to like transparency and government in our episode with Travis, and now can tie it to—
But there's things that are unsolved, like a pip install. So, that's something that just you do every day in code, right? Is the team will run just, hey, this solution is just one pip away is one thing that the community says, but that pulls it from the open web. So if there is a, if there is malware or something on that, then you have actually unintentionally created a security risk within your environment. So that's why I say some things are still unsolved, because it's like, in what ways, especially for the government, are we able to protect the supply chain of the source code where not everybody should really have access to it? We're just the right people. We want to make sure the right people are having access. And I don't know the answer to that. It's not going to be a great answer either.
that was going to be my question as kind of like a novice and being like, who are these open source? Like who, like, you know, if there's a problem, who decides the solution? I know it's community based, but then like, is there like a leader? Is there like governance within open source? And how does that work?
Yeah, there's, in order to answer for our, for like our specific use case, which is within government, I believe there has to be, because, one is the environment that hosts the community. It's a base, zero trust is a real boundary that we, in a mindset that we really strive for every single day, is you really have to have a security first mindset about your entire supply chain when it comes to the source code. And so Onyx, which Marie brought up, which is our, you know, our internal platform for data science and machine learning, that is based on open source solutions. Really is driven by the community, the government community, and how we can create a positive inflection point for all these, in complement to all these proprietary solutions. How can we just make it accessible within government? Because although nobody's answered the question of who's going to govern the system, we're definitely seeing leading indicators where there's going to be with a, like AWS GovCloud, right? There's going to be a separate system that you've got to succeed within. And the blocker is there are so many silos within government. In order to open that up, you really do need a platform that can run ubiquitously across all environments so that when that decision is ultimately made, that enables and enhances the customer's access to the tools that they need to get the job done. So there is going to be a limit on that supply chain based on who are the users of the system. But when that decision's made is, how do we reduce as much friction as possible for those folks?
Awesome. So for those that don't know, AWS is Amazon Web Services.
AWS, yeah.
And then this is kind of a question for both of you. So give us your sales pitch for Onyx.
Oh, it's not a question for me. I'm just still learning about it. Yeah,
so I know even less than Marie. So what is it you're like very novice pitch for us?
Yeah. So Onyx is our open source solution to making data science accessible for anybody within the government, any data scientist within the government, whether you're a data engineer, whether you're a data scientist, whether you're a DevOps engineer. The goal is to have the tool sets available at the right time, at the right place, no matter the status of the contract. Because so in going back to my chief digital officer days, it's the people, process, technology triangle that you really want together. Do the people have access to the right tools and technology in order to ensure the process keeps delivering? Everything goes through an acquisition cycle. Yet there are so many constraints within our acquisition cycle. It really is up to empowered individuals to figure out how to solve that. Onyx is a great solution to that because it overcomes that constraint. When the contract ends, because the tool is open source based, then it keeps going. Your organic software engineers, your organic data scientists, your organic engineers, they maintain access to those tools. You might not go as fast because you don't have access to, you know, our super smart folks who can really, you know, deliver new models or deliver this, you know, additional tool sets that you need, but the job doesn't stop. So the triangle stays. Your people maintain access to the tools. The process is actually what we sell, which is access to an ongoing process, because when the contract ends, the process doesn't have to stop because of the work and the tools are available so the team can continue with their within their own intellectual space to deliver and grow on the mission.
I have a follow-up question. I feel like I'm learning a lot. So.
No, keep asking. These are great questions.
So is Onyx... I'm sure it's MetroStars IP, but then it, because it's open source, could like someone else use the same technology?
Yeah, well, that's where it takes the community. That's the community mindset that we want to bring. And it's disruptive, right? It's like, wait, you mean that when we leave, they can still, that's the goal, is to, based on this positive disruption for the community. It's like Uber, right? Is the taxi companies are still going to be there. All the proprietary platforms that are out there and the solutions that they've invested in solving, they deserve whatever income that provides. However, the community and the need space is so large that there has to be something else available. So it's like the tools that are within our pipeline that Onyx really is the orchestrator of, is yes, there is a license that goes with that, but that's an excessive, that's every tool that we use has a license. It's just for the government. Can they use the tool for whatever use case they need? And does that license block them from doing the work that they need? And for the proprietary things is like, well, yeah, you part of that buying the license is like a yearly license, and then you get all the support you have, but that year ends. And then what? Because funding is not promised to tomorrow. We had to overcome that licensing piece. And so we were able to actually do a execute a proof of concept for the Air Force around that structure. And it was very successful and is something that we continue to deliver now with, you know, I think three different contracts that have just three different, completely different ecosystems and use cases that have seen the viability for Onyx in their environment and the flexibility and how it does help them really solve that core need, which is just basic access. And then once you get to the level of those big, needing the big solution and going to buy that, we're not stopping you from doing that. So we're almost helping industry as well, because industry, it's like using a bazooka to sharpen a pencil, right? It's almost, if they get there and they see that the mission is too small for them, they're just going to sit around and twiddle their thumbs. That's lost funding for the government. That's lost value for the customer. But it's frustration because the customer asked for a tool, but they didn't really necessarily understand where they were on the maturity scale. And so when you get in, that's part of, you know, that balance of going for me where I was the customer, but also looking at now where I'm in industry is you've got to be flexible. You've got to be able to flex in that space so you're not wasting money. So the customer can use you immediately, like day zero, day one, you're up and running. But at the same time, when they get to day 99, the work doesn't stop because your platform is only at X level of maturity.
So that's very cool.
Yeah, no, it is really cool. I'd like to jump into talking about like the data that you guys can pull for proof of concepts, or most recently, you guys are doing something with veterans. Would you like to jump in on that?
Yeah. So, there's a couple things, you know, for veterans, but so one piece is suicide awareness and working with Andrew, who's LinkedIn famous, to
love Andrew's LinkedIn's.
Yeah. No, but really is being, so I'm in the reserves now, continuing to do more for the mission and take action. I'm very action oriented, just as my philosophy. And this does get into a little bit on your questions in previous podcasts around ethical, right? Ethics, yeah. Ethical AI. But it goes towards how do we, with the information that's accessible out there through for the everyday person, how can we bring awareness to mental health for veterans and to help veterans with mental health issues take action? And we do have some ideas that are out there, but it really does come down to the fundamentals of the data sources, the use case, right? The user telling the story, and how we can take the data, sprinkle in data journalism, which is one of those. It's such an emerging fun one that I think you guys future podcasts around, like bringing a data journalist. I would love to like bring them to train the team, cool. Because it really is telling a story with data where you can see the message. It's like this. It's like using all your senses to tell a story. It's where you can see the message, you can hear the message, you can feel the impact. And then also you can inspire others to take action. So with that veteran community, it's okay within this chart. And this is ideating with Andrew, right? This is back of the napkin stuff is okay. So we can take a proprietor. So we have somebody who built a business who was in a bad space mentally as they were a veteran who told this story. And this is how they really got out of their valley of despair and the turning point. And how can we look at those turning points and put data to them as milestones that everybody goes through. Not everybody, but I would say that a majority of veterans and a majority of people who, you know, have been a part of serving the military do understand these different milestones that you go through after you've seen combat or after you've been deployed for a long time. I've been through them. It's a common language and it's sometimes it's an unspoken language because it is about mental health. And so it's like, how do we identify these milestones based on, you know, the fact that this entrepreneur was able to execute this, you know, to get 10 widgets out this day. And then that 10 turned into 100 and 100 turned into 10,000. And that's how he knew he had a business is like the turnaround didn't happen at 10, right? They were still going through hard times at 10. They were still kind of in despair. They had belief in themselves, but they were also starting to take what was their frustration or that time that they've spent in that valley and do something constructive, not destructive with it. And that's where we want to bring the community, the veteran community together is that point where you go from destructive decision-making to constructive decision-making and then put that in a story, put that on a chart as a single dot. And that single dot grows to two dots because somebody else had that turning point. And mm-hmm. it grows to three dots because somebody else. And now what was an untold story because of the mantra or whatever, it now becomes a shareable space. And so a data story is now starting to bring the community together. And that's where we want to have an impact on mental health awareness for veterans. And what we were talking to Andrew about is really leaning in and seeing what it starts with, access to data.
Yeah. But, can you talk about some of the challenges? Because when access, we were talking about first, this episode, you were, the access to this data is not.
So, I mean, rightfully so, there's, you can exploit data for good or exploit data for bad. That's just the basics of it. And unfortunately, it's bad prevails, right? Rules are mm-hmm. written to prevent the bad pieces because a lot of information damage can be done there or exploitation. When we reached out as a team to look at these data sources and say, hey, we're doing this for good, there's a lot of constraints there. You've got to be under contract with a specific customer or be, you know, in the specific field. And we're not. We just aren't. So it really is going out and looking at and scraping the web for in scraping the web for good. And so going working around the restrictions. And that's why we pivoted to entrepreneurs, veteran entrepreneurs, to bring awareness to mental health issues, is because at that glut, I can chart in the valley, right? Mm-hmm. I can actually chart when you started to sell your first widget, right? We can chart that. We can put that on a chart, but that first widget, that 10th widget, that 100th widget, a story comes with that mm-hmm. dot, right? And so that's how we had to take a unique look at what our constraints were around data sources and then make it fit to our story and our impact that we were trying to have and fit the audience.
Nice.
There's so many things going on. First off, that's amazing that you're doing that, especially for around mental health. I know that in pop culture, mental health has gotten a big kind of, there are a lot of stigmas.
It says it feels terrible to be like, it's gotten a big boost.
Exactly.
Exposure. Positive exposure.
Yeah.
So that's just amazing that you're continuing on that path of continuing positive, exposure, positive disruption. I like that term you use. Yeah. So on the tail end of what you were just saying, you were talking about reaching the users with something like the mental health or with Onyx or with any of the data stuff that we've been going over. How would you say that making it human-centered with AI, with data, with ML has positively impacted the strides that you're trying to make?
It starts with the customer always, or the audience always. So with user-centered design, the old school mindset of data is I just need access to all the data and then I can make any decision I want. that is quickly fading as our data literacy increases as a community. But user-centered design, human-centered design, they help us, one, when you get in the room, have a discovery session, whether it's a customer engagement, whether it's an interview, whether it's just a small research paper, is we can ask and identify the right use cases to go after and the right amount or right types of data to look at and articulate. Is it structured data? Is it unstructured data? What have you done with it before? What's your level of maturity? What systems have you used in order to process or manage that data before? And what's your culture around that data? Because you might want to ask for all the data, but possession, I have learned, is a little more important than ownership of the data. So you have to understand who owns the data. Mm-hmm. And then you have to understand who possesses the data. And then you have to come to an understanding of, okay, in order to fulfill this outcome, how do we, from the beginning, right, use user-centered design to ask for the right amount of data that doesn't disrupt you? Try not to disrupt from the start, right? Is try to make it really about just trying to answer hypothesis. But as you grow forward, look at, go from the human-centered design, of the discovery phase to the delivery, because you also don't want to gold plate your solution. Software and data are the same thing. You can overbuild the data pipeline. Mm-hmm. That's why Onyx is so important. It's because we're a super clean data pipeline, machine learning operations pipeline, and that you can, it's unassertive. It's only assertive towards the fact that you got to, you know, you got to know some Python and you've got to be a data scientist, right? In delivery, it really adds the fact that human-centered design is making sure to deliver the right amount of product with the right impact, and then iterate on what the customer is making decisions on, and then push to the side what features, functions, and data that aren't important at that point.
Mm-hmm. This is like an off-the-cuff question, but from your perspective, personal experience with human-centered design, what activities would you say are your most favorite to partake in?
Oh, discovery all day.
Discovery
all day.
any particular discovery activities or all of it?
I think journey mapping.
Oh my gosh.
You were part of that, right? As soon as I landed at MetroStar, I was like, so what journey maps do you have about, you know, your products, about your, mm-hmm. your customers? So for me, I am not classically trained at all. I went to a normal school. I studied business. And you know, I flew with the Navy, so I never spoke that language, but I did a year. The Navy and the Air Force gave me an opportunity to spend a year at Kessel Run, and they were partnered with Pivotal, which is now VMware, which now just got bought by somebody else, but they have these pivots that sit with you and they talk to you and they give you insight, and they go through these sessions called discovery sessions, and you sit down and you have all these things called sticky notes, and you sit down and you have all these like just these, you're just vibing off the mm-hmm. team, like, oh my gosh, you're asking all these great questions. And the biggest impact journey maps have had on me is, I was, you know, part of the founding of a project called Mad Hatter, and that was working with the 309th out at Hill Air Force Base in order to help transform and, you know, find a better way to do things for the maintainers, specifically for a system called Alice. And we put all these, we marked out the wall. And it said, here's the role that you have, mm-hmm. and here's a day in the life. And now talk to me about your pain points, your technology that you interact with, and your actions, mm-hmm. right? Whether they're desired or executed, right? Yeah. The things that you want to do. And the first funny thing was we sat down with the maintainers, and maintainers have such a sense of community that they don't really break themselves out into subcategories of communities that is needed for actually identifying a persona. Oh. And so we sat them down and they're like, we were like, all right, so it was a group of 15 of them. And we're like, hey, teammates, what do you call yourselves? And they're like, we're maintainers. You're like, yeah, but what do you do on a daily basis? They're like, we maintain the aircraft. And you're like, yeah, but what shop are you a part of? Mm-hmm. And they're like, the maintenance shop. And we're like, we got to do better at questions.
Yeah.
And so what ended up happening was on this user journey map, it really was the exploration of introducing new ideas to the customer and getting them to talk, getting us as the team exploring to talk their language, mm-hmm. to empathize, yeah. but also getting them to open up and see that we are here to listen. It was a great listening journey. And so we got the maintainers to break down that, hey, I'm an electrician, right? I work on electronics. I am the maintenance chief. My job mm-hmm. is to ensure the aircraft is safe for flight. And so we were able to break down those nuanced personas as a maintainer that they'd never called themselves before. And it almost helped them do their job better because we helped them talk about their outcomes over their outputs, mm-hmm. right? An electrician can take a bunch of little fibers and put them together and then cap it off, and then their job is done.
Yeah.
But the electrician for that also ensures that the aircraft can take off safely with a continuity of wires that aren't gonna set on fire mid-flight, right? With a safety conscious mindset. And that jet is now able to go execute a specific mission for the United States, where we got them to talk about outcomes. And so in identifying the pain points of the user journey and just listening, the fact that it is a well-rounded approach during the discovery phase and ongoing phase, because there's a value stream mapping there. Don't let me go too deep.
You have to come back.
But there's so many more derivatives from the user journey. Starting there is such a powerful conversation point that you really get the team leaning in, and that's where you get passion. And that's where people really want to be a part of, not just the mission, but now they can tell the story a lot better.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I just got to do a journey map exercise yesterday with one of my colleagues.
Yeah.
And just like you said, we were like, oh my gosh, now we got all these personas to go dive into. And just like brightened again, because it's been a little struggle with my product owner role over there. So it was nice to, you know, get to do the discovery phase again and dive in.
It's a good reset, right?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, let's reset. Let's talk about the user journey around this like specific persona or this pain point you're having and what got you here. And because it's a good listening session, and it's like a safe space for kind of both sides being vulnerable. Because hey, I'm missing your language, or like we keep talking past each other, right? And that's not productive or constructive. But at the same time, for the customer, is let's get them out of the because the customer is going to be frustrated, right? So how do we take that frustration and turn that into constructive feedback and a constructive way to have a conversation while at the same time getting them talking? Because we definitely need their feedback and get them talking in that space.
Yeah.
For not having a UX background, you are like right there in with us.
I love it. It's amazing. Design thinking and all those things. It's empathy and listening and patience is a journey. It's like a full scale journey where when I was young and at the F-35 days, you've got to talk to, you know, people with stars on their shoulder. You've got to talk to people who just graduated college and not everybody speaks the same language, and empathy, patience, and a little bit of listening goes a long way in helping to break down those walls, because you actually need all of those personas to talk in the same language and to participate and feel like they're being heard. And it's a PhD level. It's a PhD level psychology. It's all the things, right? Because you've got to really take into account everything as you're asking the right question, like facial expressions. Did I ask the right thing? Right. The color of sticky notes, like all the, it gets weird.
Right. But and like awesome. You were saying with the questions, to like kind of learn on the spot, like, oh man, I'm not speaking their language right now. Like, how do you take that all in? Like, and adjust your questions to be like, okay, we got to get back on there where like they can trust me. And like, cause there is, I've had, when we started out on the project, completely new topic to me, we had some bomb of interviews, at least in the beginning. And I was like, oh my gosh, you can't say that. Like, and like, we're like, thankfully in the remote world, you can like text or type to the person leading the interview, the moderator. You're like, not that word, not that word. That's not like, or get them away from this kind of like with proprietary or like just. On our project, there's some stuff we're not supposed to dive into, like shift, like exit pivot, left. Pivot. Right? Go. And just because, right, we want to be respectful of the contract and the work and continue to be trusted by our client. I was like, go, no, it was like, stop, Nayday.
I guess that is the benefit of this environment that we're in, where you can be somebody's birdie on their shoulder to have a better leading conversation, where you have a level of customer intimacy that they might not have been exposed to. And you're like, don't say that word. Yeah. You can't just ever, just because it's a trigger word, and it's just like, you're going to lose the entire room. But that's one of those benefits. Yeah. That's happened.
Right.
Yeah.
It is a benefit of remote, but yeah, I do miss in-person facilitation.
Yeah, I think we're starting to get back on that track a little bit. But yeah, I was just thinking when you were saying pivot, and if we go back to real, you know, in person ones, just having like a picture of like the Friends cast with the couch, like they're like Ross. I can be your little cue card. Right.
Pivot and icebox are very, very beneficial to any session like that.
Nice. Yeah. Good tips.
So as we start to wrap up our interview with you, first off, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's been awesome. Fast.
Yeah.
Probably watch it's like an hour into it and it feels like 5 minutes.
Yeah, this has been really fascinating. I've just been like, oh, tell me more. So a couple of wrap up questions for you. One, do you have any tips for people who might be younger in their career or looking to pivot to getting into like data, AI, ML?
Take action. Take action on those things that you see as a value add to either your personal story or your professional story. Things that I've seen being part of the data community is it's very diverse, and the backgrounds of the data community are they just come from so many walks of life because data exists everywhere. So it's who in their role is able to access the data in order to improve the outcomes for the things they do day to day. These have been designers, right? These mm-hmm. have been program managers for finance. These have been program managers for product management. These have been there are so many different ways to get into the data machine learning space, which eventually leads to the deep learning side of things. Mm-hmm. And then the automation side comes from the ML operations. And then you start to get to, you know, that AI piece, augmented intelligence, artificial intelligence, things like that. And it really is looking at the tools day to day, like being willing to be a constant learner. So you've got to learn the tools, right? You've got to put the pack on, and you got to start hiking up the hill because whether you're learning SQL or whether you're learning how to, you know, write awesome like Jupyter Notebook, like there's mm-hmm. different Python, right? There's different ways in, you know, the learning curves that it takes. But in reality, you know your use case. You know the story. You also some people see how that is unpacked, how you can unpack that story in order to meet their communication outcomes or the things they need. So that takes an additional level of training, right? How do you go from data ingestion to storing? Where do I store this data? Mm-hmm. How do I process this data, right? How do I put the data together to make it make sense for me or for somebody else in a data visualization tool? All of those things are steps that you take, and active steps. So to be a part of to join the community, and this is why we reach out to open source too. Mm-hmm. There's so many new use cases emerging. There's so much diversity for the use cases for anything that can be done that, you know, it's welcome. We need that. We need your willingness to approach a problem set and leverage the data that you have access to, because somebody else is probably asking the same question mm-hmm. if you can't find it. So I mean, the next piece is if you've already got the training, I would say we're hiring. So we would love to have you and love to bring you on the team to get insights. We've short term, like we've just won some pretty mm-hmm. awesome contracts in order to facilitate a lot of customer needs, whether it's AI, whether it's RL, reinforcement learning, machine learning, basics. The customers have the gamut of needs out mm-hmm. there, and the professionals in this data space, folks that would be inspired, that we would inspire to join our team would be those. You can be an industry, right? And you can increase the number of clicks at TikTok, you know, and do the machine learning and be like, dude, I'm the best data scientist on that team. And I increase clicks by like, you know, 3 every 2 seconds, right? Yeah. That's a cool metric and all, but for the government to be able to support that mission mindset where mm-hmm. where it is meeting the national defense strategy around making sure that we're building the right tools, when we're delivering the right insight to the right customer in the right way. You're working across jets, you're working with tanks, we're working with financial systems, TSO, the mm-hmm. TSO contract. Yep. We are working across program management systems, network systems. Yeah. That is in order to accelerate the management of a worldwide network, and visibility by, 400%. That's cooler than, to me, that's cooler than TikTok. Mm-hmm. Just to kind of put that out there for kind of the difference in the mission set.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's cooler too. Yeah. I mean, right. That's why we're here.
Yeah, that's a long-winded answer to, the data, the starting, how do you get into data? But
no, it was great.
Yeah. This has been so interesting. So for you teed us up for the open job. So it's metrostar.com/join us. Mm-hmm. And then we'll also put that link in the show notes so people can have that to click on. And then, we will also, we're going to pitch doing some Onyx demos if anyone would like an Onyx demo. We will also put how to do that in the show notes, and really it's going to be reaching out to you.
Reach out to the team. We're happy to, give a demo of what we've been able to develop thus far and validate. And it's the use cases are endless. Just 30 seconds. We have an awesome one called Yield of Dreams, where we're able to take weather data, take an overlay of Google, and look at the output of a specific farmer's field so that they could estimate their annual crop yield. And so you can improve the planning.
Can you do this for my yard, for my flower garden?
For your flower garden?
In my small vegetable garden? Because, man, last year's temperatures really wrecked my pepper output.
Well, imagine those big tulip, those huge fields of tulips, right? So we could probably take that and start to create some different types of insights for maybe planning if the tulip crops, not to expect tulips this year because the supply chain is going to be limited.
But is that real? There's a lot of, are the tulips?
Really? No, I made that piece up. So
not another supply chain issue.
let's not go there, but it's just a use case.
Nice. Just saying, peppers. We didn't get many this summer.
No?
No, I've invested in making a greenhouse. This is tangent. We can talk about this later.
Okay. Lower tangents on this podcast. Well, again, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I just
learned a ton. So I'll be signing up for a demo.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then with that, this is Mockit. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share with your friends. And join us next time. If you're interested in learning more about how government and tech collide, visit us at metrostar.com and follow us along on our socials.
You watch Avalanche videos? Whatever happened to the simple ones, like the pimple poppers? Let's keep it in a safe space.